Welcome to the City Club of Eugene's September 15th, 2017 program. New superbugs, the health threat, the scary six. This is the second program of the 2017-2018 programming year. I'm Sandra Bishop, City Club President. The City Club brings together civic-minded people to make Eugene a better place to live, work, and play, and be healthy. We're a member-supported nonprofit. Our members have a direct influence on public policy. Become a member of City Club of Eugene at cityclubofeugene.org on the web. Support for City Club is provided by our members and sponsors, including Jerry Detown, landscape architect, LULAC, the League of United Latin American Citizens, the Lane County branch, and the Oregon Country Fair. And special thanks to University of Oregon Academic Extension, the Baker Center here, our venue, and special thanks to KLCC Radio. City Club programs are broadcast on public radio station KLCC 89.7 at 6:30 p.m. on Mondays. The coordinator of today's program is Marty Wilde, and we want to give a special thank you to Marty for organizing this important discussion. Thank you. So now to our program. For nearly a century, bacteria-fighting drugs known as antibiotics have helped to control and destroy many of the harmful bacteria that make us sick. But in recent decades, the question of whether antibiotics have been losing their punch against some of the types of bacteria due to overuse of these life-saving drugs, and what the future implications are of this overuse has gained the attention of everyone from public health to Hollywood. In fact, some researchers are concerned that certain bacteria are now unbeatable with today's medicines. So that's what we're going to talk about today. And we're honored today to have Dr. Ludke as our main speaker. Originally, another doctor who was an infectious disease specialist was invited to co-present that information. It's hard for Dr. Ludke to just put out all the information in one flow, though he is a very good speaker. So Jason Davis, the Public Information Officer for Lane County Health and Human Services, has graciously agreed to step in and help facilitate today's conversation. So just briefly, our speaker today, Dr. Patrick Ludke, serves as Lane County's Senior Public Health Officer. Dr. Ludke's office is the Lane County Public Health, and it's under Human Services in the county. This department advises county government on health issues and coordinates with the broader clinical community, tracking communicable diseases, leading preparedness initiatives, all sorts of work to lower the risk factors in the community. Dr. Ludke is a primary care and preventative medicine physician. He trained and received his MD at the Medical College of Wisconsin, Marquette University, and completed his training in internal medicine at the Naval Hospital in Oakland, California. He holds a Master's of Public Health degree from the University of Utah, and he also served for 12 years in the military, active duty as a medical doctor in the Navy. So I think that gives him an incredible breadth and depth when he's talking about communicable diseases as we are today and these kind of bacteria that are growing stronger and stronger. He's seen it all around the world. And so Jason, who's going to help out today to facilitate the conversation, is the Public Information Officer, as I said, for Lane County Health and Human Services. Jason comes from a crisis communications background. Hopefully we won't need that with him at the county. Jason moved to Eugene about 5 years ago and at the same time started working with public health at the county. The way he expresses it, he says he moved to the right coast from New York. And so it's good to see someone in Jason's position, who has gone from, he has a lot of experience working with large corporations, Microsoft, you know, T-Mobile, NGOs. He's chosen, as he said, he saw the light one day, and he's chosen service in public health. So we look forward to having these two gentlemen interact over some of the important information, and then we'll have a short break and come up with our questions. So Dr. Ludke, Jason.
Thank you, Sandra. And so just to explain, I'm going to act as essentially a media professional interviewing Dr. Ludke, which we're both familiar with. We actually run a little public health radio show every week where we do this dog and pony show. So hopefully it will go over. Are you ready, Doctor?
I am ready. I do wonder how many listen to Health Matters, our weekly radio show, but we will stay away from any advertising.
Promoting other radio shows while on the radio. That's a good idea. So first off, can you give us a brief rundown of the history of antibiotics and what brought us to the situation we're experiencing today?
Thank you for the word brief, because it will be brief. I think the history of antibiotics is really fascinating. And of course, Mother Nature has used antibiotics for centuries in various ways. Plants have fought off other plants and not allowed them to grow, and animals have fought off other animals, etc. But in terms of antibiotic use in the human realm, Alexander Fleming, a famous Scottish physician, discovered penicillin serendipitously doing some research with petri dishes, and went on vacation and came back and found that a lot of the bugs that he was plating on those plates were growing, but in one particular place where a mold was growing, there was a zone of no growth around that mold. That particular bacteria, it was a streptococcal bacteria, didn't grow, which is kind of fascinating. And it was, that was 1928. And multiple scientists over the next decade realized that we could do something about that and grow these penicillin molds and extract the antibiotic from it and use it. And the first big use was in World War II, actually. Saved probably thousands of lives in World War II from minor injuries. But it really didn't, penicillin didn't come into big use until about 1943, and then readily available right at the end of the war in the Western world in 1945. So that was the first antibiotic.
So, thank you for that, by the way. Our situation right now, superbugs, is it a foregone conclusion in the clinical world that the overuse of antibiotics is inadvertently creating drug-resistant bacteria?
Well, I think I would say a qualified yes. And one of the reasons I say qualified is because there clearly are bacteria out there that, for whatever reason, are still sensitive to everything we throw at them. A classic one is syphilis. Thankfully, the syphilis bacteria has been sensitive to penicillin since we've had penicillin. And today, when I see a patient at the health department in our STD clinic, I still treat that patient, if they have syphilis, with penicillin. So I said qualified simply because not every bacteria has shown this real predilection to become resistant to everything we throw at it. But, of course, many have.
So of those many, that creates a situation that's problematic and also the topic of our conversation today. And oftentimes when it becomes apparent that there is a man-made element to a health crisis, such as this one, we want to assign blame. So is there a specific group or individual or groups who are to blame for this?
Oh, gosh. Being put on the spot. There's no one group, no one person involved. But clearly, this is a system issue. So we have the prescribers, nurse practitioners, physicians, physician assistants, who may overprescribe on occasion or may not prescribe to the highest level of our data out there that supports it. We have patients who are overly seeking antibiotics. I have a scratchy throat, and my wedding is in 2 days, or I have a big talk, a big presentation. Can't you give me some antibiotic just in case I might get streptococcal infection? So we have that push. We have, if you look at the pharmaceutical industry, I think that if there's not a lot of profit in some of these medications, there's not a lot of research in them. And we could go through the litany of all the antibiotic groups that came after penicillin in 1928, and there were many, the tetracyclines, the erythromycin-based drugs, the penem-based drugs, but there haven't been really new groups for a decade or so, maybe even close to 20 years, because there just hasn't been the pharmaceutical interest. So there's probably a pharmaceutical or a research role in that. So long answer to your question, many of us are culpable.
Thank you. So if we have the situation on our doorstep, the awareness that we have about it largely comes from the media and then also Hollywood. So how would you help us understand the actual implications of having drug-resistant bacteria among us versus the sensationalized version?
Oh, so I think that let's start with Hollywood. That's the easy one. Certainly there are a few bacteria out there that are resistant to everything that we have presently. And that may seem extraordinarily frightening, and it is pretty frightening. But our body is pretty adept at killing off a lot of different things. We're exposed every day. We eat way more bacteria than I think we'd be comfortable talking about during a lunchtime session. But we're eating them all day. And we have multiple different ways to fight them off, even if we have an antibiotic that isn't really successful. So that's probably number one. Number two, I guess that being said, there are people who each year get an infection with one of these superbugs, so to speak, and they're otherwise a healthy person. They have a normal immune system. They don't have someone else's kidney inside of them, and they're taking anti-rejection drugs, so they don't reject that kidney, and those medications make their immune system less effective. In every other respect, they have a normal chance of fighting it off, and yet the bacteria sets up its infection in your lungs, in the skin, wherever it might be, and it grows and grows, and there's nothing we can do. So that is frightening, I think. But there are less Hollywood-esque ways. So antibiotics are not benign drugs. Just the name, Against Life, Antibio, I mean, it tells you something. And, you know, all medications have side effects. So there are literally tens of thousands of people who show up in an ED, every year with allergic reactions to antibiotics. It's probably the number one medication-related presentation to a hospital. It's about 20% of all medication-related presentations for allergies. Of course, we can be allergic to other things, but needless to say, there are allergies. Also, antibiotics kill off the good bacteria. More and more these days, we're realizing that we need good bacteria. They do a lot of different things, not just crowding out the bad bacteria. Some bacteria make vitamin K for us. We need vitamin K for clotting. Many people have probably never heard of vitamin K. We can't make it ourselves. We can't clot our blood without it, and bacteria in our gut make it for us. So we don't want to kill all these bacteria off. So there are multiple different reasons to be careful and safe with antibiotics and to be careful and safe with these infections that may come about from organisms that we have to throw everything at it, including the kitchen sink, because the kitchen sink can cause damage.
So, since we are expanding our knowledge on the subject, can you help us understand how these superbugs are created?
Yes. So, really, there's two main ways, essentially. There's the genetic way. So, just like a human baby often looks like mom and dad, it's passed genetically, it's the same with bacteria. If there's a bacteria out there that is resistant to penicillin, its offspring are probably going to be resistant to penicillin. So we call that vertical transmission, going from mother to daughter or son. But then there's the horizontal transmission, which is the sharing of those genes across various species. Bacteria, interestingly, can share their genes in multiple different ways, sort of mating like humans, like other animals. But they can also just leave residue around, and other bacteria can pick up their DNA and share it. We don't do that as humans. We don't pick up other DNA. We may bump into somebody's hair or skin cells, but we don't have a way of picking up DNA and changing our genetics. Bacteria can do that, and they do it quite readily. So that horizontal transmission of sharing DNA, sharing resistance genes where you can fight off the antibiotic, is what's really quite frightening. And because bacteria can multiply very quickly, E. coli, for example, bacteria were probably all commonly known, and it causes diarrhea and various illnesses in the gut, can double every 20 minutes in perfect conditions. So if you can spread your DNA around and then you can double every 20 minutes, it's pretty quickly spread amongst the community of bacteria, and pretty soon they're all resistant.
Thank you. So in your opinion, what are the most worrisome drug-resistant bacterial strains in terms of population health?
So we talk, the title of this, about the scary six, and I'm going to narrow it even down to, if we get time, especially with the question session, we'll talk about all six. But there's three right now that the Center for Disease Control, based in Atlanta here, that's our big public health mothership in this country, and the World Health Organization, based in Geneva, Switzerland, there are three that they're kind of focusing in on even further. One of them, is called carbapenem-resistant Enterobacteriaceae. Such a long name. Carbapenem is a class of antibiotics, and Enterobacteriaceae is a big group of bacteria that live in our gut. Like enteritis is an inflammation in your intestines. So these are common bacteria that live in our gut. And penems, that class of antibiotics, are kind of our last resort, or one of our last resort classes. They're very powerful antibiotics. They work very well broad spectrum, so they kill lots of different bacteria, skin bacteria, gut bacteria, lung bacteria, etc. But this group, these CRE bacteria, they are able to break down that antibiotic before it can kill the bacteria. And as you might imagine, people with serious illnesses, people who end up, say, in an intensive care unit, and penicillin hasn't worked, and erythromycin hasn't worked, and we give them penems, if they have a CRE infection, it may not work. And another reason it's on the list of the big three is because about half of people who get a CRE infection will die. Thankfully, the numbers are not huge. We're not talking about tens of thousands, but we're talking about a couple thousand. It's a lot of deaths each year. And the spread of the CRE bacteria across the country and the world is quite alarming, and there's a lot of disease surveillance systems now looking at it. So that's number one. Number two is good old gonorrhea. Sorry to mention that at lunch as well, but we may have all sorts of reasons where people, you know, pull back on spending and the Wall Street meltdown, various recessions, etc., but people rarely stop having sex. So gonorrhea just keeps spreading. And we have seen resistant gonorrhea strains basically every time we have a new class of antibiotics. Within 5 to 10 years, there are gonorrhea strains out there resistant. So gonorrhea became resistant to penicillin 50 years ago, became resistant to the tetracyclines about 40 years ago, became resistant to those fluoroquinolones, another big class. A common one is called Cipro. Many of you have probably heard of Cipro. Became resistant to the fluoroquinolones about 20, 25 years ago. Significant resistance to another class called cephalosporins. Common antibiotics were used for skin infections, about 10 or 15 years ago. So gonorrhea is just on the march, and it's common. It's a really common infection. So that one's frightening as well. And then the last one is an interesting bacteria, because it's not directly resistant to antibiotics, but it has a different type of resistance. And the bacteria is called Clostridium difficile, or we just call it C. diff for short. And C. diff causes nasty chronic diarrhea, even in people with a normal immune system. And C. diff is a normal component of those bacteria in our intestinal tract. We all have a little bit at any given time. It comes and goes. But there's so much competition in our intestines because there's so many bacteria that it just can't overgrow. The other bacteria are stealing its food, and it can't overgrow. But the challenge with C. diff is when you get an antibiotic and it kills all those competitors, C. diff might not die, and then it gets all the food. And it grows and grows and grows, and it releases these toxins, and you get this debilitating, terrible diarrhea. Thousands of people die from it each year. I've had many patients with chronic C. diff infections. They might have 50 or 60 severe diarrheal episodes in a year. And if you ever had diarrhea for a week, you know how debilitating it can be. You can be really bedridden. So C. diff, again, it's not really resistant in and of itself. Once you get it and we diagnose it, we can kill it pretty readily. It might come back again, but we can kill it fairly readily at least once or twice. But anytime you have it set up shop in your intestine, it's hard to completely eradicate it. We can knock the numbers down. You might feel better for a week or two, but it might come, you know, storming back again. So those are the big three that at least public health from the CDC side is really, really focusing on.
You always have a way of making horrifying things sound not quite so horrifying. And I'm going to go off script here, so get ready. I know you love this. Do you feel that this issue has risen to an appropriate place of importance within the research community?
The research community. Well, I would say there clearly are many working on it. And there are monies out there coming from Uncle Sam, and there are some pharmaceutical monies coming out there as well. I would really like to see more. I think that we need several new classes of antibiotics, completely novel, complete new ones, bacteria have never seen before, that are safe and effective. So while there is a funding stream out there for some of this work, I don't think there's enough. What can I do about it? Well, advocate. I don't have a checkbook I can open up with enough money and make a difference, but I think we can do more.
And on that note, what is public health doing to mitigate the impacts to communities?
So we are doing a lot of things. I would hope that many listeners are aware of some of them. We, as we mentioned earlier, we have a public health radio show called Health Matters. We talk about it broadly on our radio show. We have a lot of public health messaging to the community, both broadly through some of our PSAs, our public service announcements, as well as individually in schools and at other sites. We also work with the clinical community, so more focused, targeted conversations, and helping clinics and hospitals look at programs to help them assess, address, and limit the possibility of antibiotic-resistant organisms. We do a lot of that provider-based training using some tools from the CDC and some we've developed internally. And then I would also hope that we have the opportunity to work with some of those less than readily recognized groups that can make a difference too. So that includes businesses, that includes various research entities that are not directly related to coming up with a new antibiotic, but maybe related to determining the best use for those particular medications. I think we're doing a lot, actually, especially with a limited budget.
So enough about us. What about the healthcare community at large?
So I think they're doing a lot as well. I suspect many listeners are aware of antibiotic rotation that hospitals do, for example. There are many hospitals in our area and across the country where for 6 months we'll say this intensive care unit is using this antibiotic, and then to prevent resistance from growing, we'll switch 6 months later to another one and do that rotation so you don't have that continual exposure of bacteria to the same type of antibiotics so they can develop resistance. There's a lot of disease surveillance going on, a lot of tracking. We want to find these CRE organisms, for example. If we have one or two in our area, we want to find them. We want to do a lot of investigation around it, and our hospitals are doing that quite readily. There also are sort of specific logistical things that hospitals do and clinics do under, I guess, the rubric of infection control. We have special infection control rooms. They're negative pressure rooms. So if somebody has an infection that is respiratory, then it's a negative pressure room, meaning where I'm sitting, my pressure is more negative than people out in the audience. So all of the wind blows toward me. None of my breathing goes out to you, so you can't get this from me. So we have special negative pressure rooms. We cohort patients in hospitals. If you have two people who have this infection, you put them together and keep them away from everybody else. So there's a lot of logistical infection control that happens in hospitals as well.
So empowering the community, what can they do? What can the Lane County, the people of Lane County do to help curb this problem?
Well, I think first we want to start with prevention. So it's always best to prevent the infection, even though we have this amazing ability to fight off infections. We all have been infected on occasion with bacteria, viruses, fungi, parasites, whatever it may be. But we have good ideas of how to fight these things off. So I apologize for the broken record, but wash your hands, please. How many times have you heard that from us? Wash your hands frequently. Soap and water is wonderful. If you don't have access to soap and water, you can use some of those hand sanitizers, typically alcohol-based hand sanitizers. So that's one big one. We like to talk about respiratory etiquette. A lot of these bacteria are respiratorily spread, so singing and sneezes and coughs. And we want people to cover their cough. We want people to, again, wash their hands if they've covered their cough with their hand. If you're using a tissue, we want people to throw the tissue away, not put it in your pocket and fondle it every few minutes and then go shake somebody's hand. That's respiratory etiquette. And we'd like to see more of that in the community. So that's another one. And then also food and water is a way that we get some of these scary bacteria, food especially. And people need to be careful with their food. So adequate cooking. If you're cooking poultry, if you're cooking chicken, go to the temperature recommended for cooking and for the length of time. We do get some of these superbugs coming from the agricultural industry. There's a lot of antibiotic use there, and I suspect we'll probably have a few questions about that. So be careful with your food and with your water as well.
So I'm going off script again, just because we have enough time. So the implications are pretty dire, if this goes unchecked. But in your opinion, is there a light at the end of the tunnel? Are we doing enough to prevent widespread disease outbreaks?
Oh, gosh. Are we doing enough? Well, this is interesting. My last job before I moved to Oregon, I was the state public health lab director in Utah. And every state has a state public health lab, and those labs not only oversee all the other laboratories. Utah, we had 2,000 clinical labs doing human testing, and we certified all of them. But we also do all the disease outbreak testing, or the suspicious packages, the white powder threat letters with anthrax and those sort of things. And my molecular biology director in that particular program had a license plate that said virus on it. And the rim around her license plate said, the bugs are winning. And, you know, I'll never forget that. First of all, she was a character, but every day I came to work, and she always beat me to work, it seems, and I'm staring at her license plate, the bugs are winning. And it's a real sobering thought. It's, okay, we're going to fight the bugs today. So we're doing a lot, but the bugs are out there. They're not going to go away. They're as likely to survive anything as we are, in fact, probably more likely to survive an asteroid hitting our planet or some unforeseen misery. So we could be better prepared. We could be doing more. Am I scared? No. Am I concerned? I'm concerned. And I'm not sure if I answered your question.
I think as best you can. That's sort of a tough one. But another one briefly here. This is not a national problem. This is a global problem because antibiotics are available globally. So how are we doing as compared to other nations?
Our surveillance system is pretty good. In every state, there is something equivalent to what's called a communicable disease rule, which means that clinical entities have to report diseases to public health. In our state, we have about 70 conditions that are reportable to public health, and we get all of that data, and we're tracking it. And I think our surveillance is pretty good. We have people who get the test, and they report the result to public health, and then we do an analysis, a disease investigation on it. That's a good thing. And, you know, we're probably in the top 10, I would say, of countries on the planet doing that sort of work. But there's always more to do. And when you look at holes in the system, bacteria don't respect country borders, you know, and anything is just a plane flight away, as we found out with Ebola. Whoever would have thought we'd have Ebola in this country, as we did in 2014? You don't think these things will happen. But so there's clearly much more that can be done. If I were to go back to the pharmaceuticals and trying to get new classes of antibiotics, the CDC is pushing a lot of research in that area, and the federal government is coming out with some grants to try to nudge the research apparatus to do more of that. But we're not where I would like us to be in that regard.
Well, Sandra, we have exhausted our questions, so I think now is a great time to take a break.
Thank you very much. Great. We're gonna break for about 5 minutes for those of you around the tables and in the room to formulate your questions, and then we'll return with audience questions.
This is KLCC Eugene 89.7, KLCO Newport 90.5, 89.1 KLFR Reedsport, and at 88.1 KLFO Florence, KMPQ Roseburg, KLBR Bend. KLCC is a service of Lane Community College. We're on Facebook and Twitter and online at klcc.org.
Welcome back to the September 15th City Club program. New Superbugs Health Threat, the Scary Six. We have Dr. Patrick Ludke here from Lane County Senior, he is Lane County's Senior Public Health Officer from Lane County Public Health. So please go ahead, Jerry.
Jerry Smith, City Club member. I volunteer with large numbers of homeless people. And I see kind of a plague that's going on now where people are terribly hurt with MRSA. Do they get that at the hospital, or are there places they can avoid going to get MRSA?
Thank you for the question. So MRSA is methicillin-resistant Staph aureus. Staph is a very common bacteria, lives on our skin. But of course, most of that Staph bacteria is not resistant to the antibiotic methicillin. We all have it on our skin, the normal kind, so to speak. Years ago, MRSA first started popping up in institutions, so hospitals and jails. Now there's community-acquired MRSA, and you can get it out in the community, and it's actually quite common out in the community. So those persons could have gotten it in a hospital, but more than likely, they probably got it out in the community.
Hello, Mariah Learn, and my question is, in your opinion, what connection, if any, is there between antibiotic use in animal agriculture and resistance in humans and human disease, antibiotic resistance in humans?
So for some antibiotics, there's appears to be a very clear link, and the research has grown in the last 10 to 15 years and some really good studies run on when various antibiotics were introduced into feedlots, for example, and what happened to the types of bacteria present in those animals, and then what happened to the types of bacteria in the workers of those companies, and then what happened once the food got out into the food chain and others who used it, shows a pretty clear link. One of the best links is, again, with that group of antibiotics called fluoroquinolones, of which the common one, Cipro, is one of the members, clearly showing how increased use of it in animal feedlots and other parts of animal industry and growing meats especially, resulted in resistance of the bacteria and then spread of it into other groups. We don't have as good a data for some of the other types of antibiotics, but clearly the concept that can happen has been demonstrated to be true. And again, we just don't have as many different types of antibiotics. We have, you know, a half dozen or so major different classes of antibiotics, and when you've completely caused resistance to one of those groups, you have less bullets in your armamentarium, I guess, to put it.
I'm Jack Dresser. I know there's that the National Institutes of Health have vastly more money than CDC. And so I'm wondering if there are any of the NIH institutes that focus to any significant degree on infectious disease.
They do. So NIAID, the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, is one of the institutes of NIH. And that group, as the name implies, focuses a great deal on infectious diseases. That being said, there's a large amount of its budget that goes into vaccines, a significant amount that goes into research into the bacteria themselves. And it's not the NIH's business to create new sellable antibiotics. So coming out with medications really requires a lot of cooperation. You need the bench-level scientists to assess what compounds might actually prevent the growth of organisms. Then you need a different group of scientists to determine what the chemical makeup of that particular group or antibiotic will be, and then somebody has to create it and formulate it and decide, is it going to be an oral medication? Is it going to be an injectable medication? And how do you make it so it's safe? And then a whole other group of researchers to do the testing and compare it with a gold standard and see how effective it is. So I think your question, though, about how can the NIH get involved is a good one. What else can the federal government be doing in that area? I think that's a good thought.
Susan Conley, City Club member, thank you so much for coming today. It's been written that we as patients contribute to this problem by not finishing our prescriptions up. We feel a little better and we stop. So my question is, so if a person doesn't finish her prescription, does she then become more apt to be resistant? Does the population at large become more apt? How does this work?
I wish I had a simple answer to that question. I'm sure there are many in the audience today who remember when we used to treat certain infections for 2 weeks. That was the standard. In my career, I started in medicine in the 1980s, and we used to treat urinary tract infections, which are really common, you know, hundreds of thousands in this country each year. We used to treat them for 2 weeks, and then it was shortened to 10 days, and it was shortened to 7 days. And for quite a few years, we found that just 3 days can be very effective. And no doubt there are some women and some men who say, when I feel a urinary infection coming on, I just take antibiotics, one pill sometimes, or 1 day's worth. So it really depends on the type of infection. That's number one. Number two, not all bacteria, especially bacteria, grow at the same pace. And so with that as a thought, if you can kill the bacteria with a certain antibiotic within a course of, say, 2 or 3 or 4 days of treatment, that may be enough for your native immune system to come in and kill it for the rest. Whereas other rapidly growing ones, you really have to knock it down to just a very small number of bugs so it doesn't come back. And then I think the third general thought is antibiotics are different in terms of their half-life in our body, how long they stay around. So for some antibiotics, penicillin is one of them, you wash it out of your blood system into your urine in just a couple hours very quickly. And unless it's an extended release type of formulation, it's not around very long. So the bacteria are not being exposed to it for very long. Other antibiotics, you've probably heard of the Z-Pak, azithromycin is that medicine. You only take it once a day. It can stay in your body a single pill for a day, day and a half, 2 days. So missing a pill is a little less important in an antibiotic like that can stay for a long time. And then one other thought, antibiotics really only have two ways to get out of your body. Either they go out in your urine or they go out in your feces, either unchanged or metabolized, broken down into products. And people do those activities at a different rate as well. So it's a little variant upon our individual biochemistry as well. So there's a lot of variables involved. In general, the science we have today, there are reasons why we say for strep throat, you take this antibiotic for 10 days. For a urinary tract infection, you take it for 3 days. We've followed most of those variables. We've looked at the pharmaceutical variables. We look at the biochemical variables in the person. We look at the variables of the bacteria that's most likely causing the infection. And for most people, these are the regimens that work. You can increase the risk of resistance if you partially kill the bacteria, because if you think about sort of the population of it, you have 1 million bacteria, let's say, for purposes of explanation, you have 1 million bacteria causing your infection. You take an antibiotic, there's no antibiotic that kills 100% of them first time through. So let's say you killed 90%. So now you're down to 100,000. If you stopped at that moment, you still have 100,000 bacteria that then can double every 20 minutes or more, and they'll come back. So it's wise to take them until they're gone, until you've reached the recommended amount.
John DeLow, City Club member. I have a question about bacteria versus virus. We have all these medications for bacteria, but nothing that I know of anyway for virus. Why is virus so hard to fight?
So that's a really good question. And, you know, viruses and bacteria are very, very different. Viruses need our human machinery to make more of themselves. Bacteria can be free living. They live on the surface of our skin. They live on the surface of floors and countertops. They can multiply in and of themselves, whereas viruses, they come inside of our cells, and our cells make more of them, and then they burst out of the cell and go infect new cells. So if you just think of that life cycle of viruses, it's hard to kill them because in some ways they're not really alive anyway. You know, technically they are, but they really require us. So there are some treatments for viruses. If anyone's ever had the flu and you caught it early and you went to your primary care provider and you got a flu test and it said you definitely have the flu, you can take a medication, like Tamiflu is one of them, that will shorten the course of influenza infection and will decrease your symptoms. If you get beyond about day 5, it won't do anything. You're going to go the whole course of flu and be miserable for a week or so. But you're right. There are just not that many antiviral medications. I guess another classic example is HIV. You know, HIV was first reported in this country in 1981. Years went by before we had anything, any antiviral out there. And now when we treat people with HIV, we have multiple classes of antivirals, and they're typically taking 4, 5, 6, 7 different medicines because we don't have the perfect silver bullet, magic bullet to kill it. So it's hard. Viruses are hard to kill.
Greetings. Paul Thompson, a City Club member for some time. Thank you very much for coming. As a retired engineer, you piqued my interest when you used the word novel in some of the potential antibiotics. I wonder if you could elaborate a little bit more as to what some of the novel dimensions might be, other than just using the chemicals that we have. Maybe some genetic engineering, like is being used for cancer nowadays and so on. So give us some more data on that.
I think it's a fascinating growth area, and pharmaceutical companies are looking at it. Some of them have put money behind it. If you think about yourself as a bacteria, which is kind of fun to do sometimes, how can you fight off this particular antibiotic? So you could make a chemical that directly interacts with this other chemical, because antibiotics are just chemicals, and you could have a chemical reaction with it and break it in two so it can't kill you. And antibiotics very clearly do that. They make enzymes that break up penicillin. A very common one is called beta-lactamase. It's an enzyme. Penicillin has a carbon ring. It's called the lactamase ring, the lactam ring, and beta-lactamase breaks it up, and it makes penicillin no longer work. So there are multiple antibiotics that work that way. They target directly the antibiotic to break it up. Another way is, well, okay, the antibiotic is floating by the bloodstream, and I'm a bacteria in the bloodstream, and it's going to come in contact with me no matter what I do. But if it comes inside of me, why don't I increase pumping it out? So some bacteria, they have a genetic way of increasing the pump to pump that penicillin or other antibiotic out. There are multiple really novel ways that bacteria get resistance. It's really fascinating. So genetically, bacteria, as I mentioned, they can mutate as they multiply very, very quickly, and those mutations can spread. Again, that horizontal, the vertical, and the horizontal way that they spread. The mutations can very, very quickly break down the antibiotic or prevent them from being killed by it, and then they spread the mutation. So can we induce mutations genetically in bacteria? Probably a parallel to that is we're now releasing sterile mosquitoes in places that have malaria and have other mosquito diseases so that they may mate, but there'll be no offspring. Can we do that with select bacteria and reduce them into the environment? It'll take a lot of approvals before we can do that, but people are looking at that as well. So, and there are a lot of other really interesting genetic ways of altering bacteria that are being looked at. I wish I was a geneticist and could tell you all of them, but it's a fascinating area of research.
Jane Smith, City Club member. A common way that people use to keep themselves healthy is to eat probiotics, either in yogurt or some other way. Is that effective to maintain health and resist bacterial infections? And if so, given every kind of yogurt has a different mix of bacteria, how can you tell what's more effective?
So there's a growing body of research in the land of cultures and probiotics, et cetera. And it's pretty clear that it can work, and it can work really well for some people. But it can work a little bit for most everyone. And it's kind of a little bit counterintuitive, because one of the body defense mechanisms we have is a battery acid level pH in our stomach. And as I was saying earlier, we eat a lot of bacteria that we would rather not know about, but it's on our food, it's in our water, it's in our even in our milk a little bit, etc. Most of it, the vast majority, is killed in our gut. Once it gets into our stomach, that acid kills it, and then the food goes through our intestines and we absorb the nutrients we want. But some of those bacteria survive. And competition in the gut prevents those bad bacteria from taking over and causing bad infection in most of us. And that's sort of the theory of probiotics. It's usually a pill. You take it. Sometimes they're suppositories. Most people don't like those. But it's usually a pill. And some of that bacteria survives and sets up shop in your body. And as to the question of which one should we take, the lactobacillus, or, you know, fill in the blank of which particular culture you want to take, I don't think our data is sophisticated enough to know. We know that there are various good bacteria that we really want to have more of, or at least some of. But do we want to have 10, 20, 60, 100 times more? Do we need to take these sort of probiotic pills once a day, once a week, once a month? Because some of the bacteria, if they find a favorable environment, they're going to set up shop and live. We don't need to keep taking them. So we don't know those answers. The research isn't good enough to show. The last thing I'll say on that question is, we call this the microbiome. That's the name of, you know, this biological area where these little microbes live. And there's a lot of microbiome research. And I don't think a week goes by, maybe a month goes by, where there's not some big study about the importance of your individual microbiome environment and how the microbiome helps make serotonin. And of course, serotonin is part of our system of antidepression. There's serotonin in our brain. Drugs like Prozac do something with serotonin in our brain. Turns out bacteria play with the serotonin levels in our gut and may affect our depression. It's just fascinating, the level of research going on. So it may be reasonable to take some probiotics, but probably not multiple times a day.
Hi, my name is Raisa Maddox. I'm representing Capella Market, a City Club sponsor since 2014. My question for you is whether there's a correlation between the rise in popularity of antibacterial household items and bacterial resistance or resistance in antibiotics.
So that's an interesting question. It's about a year ago, it might have been this month, or a year ago in October, where the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, withdrew a class of some of these consumer-available antimicrobials. One of them was triclosan. It's in toothpaste. It's in various house cleaning products. It's in some hand sanitizers. And it turned out that it was probably causing significant resistance in the bacterial community, and it wasn't helping in terms of overall infection rates. So the FDA, again, about a year ago, came out and said, we need to remove these from the market. There's another one. I think it was called trichlorocarbon. But they were removed from the market. And I think that data is pretty compelling, and it's fairly clear that they can affect the microenvironment. To what extent? I don't think our data is good enough to say that a specific outbreak was caused by overuse of this particular antimicrobial. But it was concerning enough, the data was concerning enough, that it was changing the resistance in the community of various bacteria that they were removed from the market. And not that I have any power, but I supported that. I think that there is overuse of some of those chemicals. And we do need to have various bacteria in our lives for a variety of reasons, not only to keep our immune system trained and up to speed, but as we've learned from studies of children, that kids raised in an overly sterile environment versus kids raised on a farm, for example, where they're exposed every day to a lot of bacteria, there may be significant differences in allergies later in their life, including not just skin allergies and eczema, but more severe allergies like allergic asthma. So we need some dirt in our lives. I think telling the kids to go play in the dirt is not always a bad thing.
I'm Ida Keir. How are doctors out of hospitals doing in terms of decreasing prescriptions? You mentioned hospital programs to alternate or cycle different ones. But how are doctors in private practice, both locally and more widely, doing? And is there monitoring programs?
So I'll take your last question first. We don't directly monitor antibiotic use at the individual provider level. And we rely, and I'm speaking for public health now, we rely on the infection control programs within clinics, urgent care facilities, et cetera, to do that work. And we rely a little bit also on the payers. You know, ultimately, antibiotics cost, and payers don't want to pay for what really isn't clinically indicated. So if a provider, if a doc or a nurse practitioner is still treating a UTI, a urinary tract infection, with 2 weeks of antibiotics, some of the payers are not going to pay for that. So there's a subtle, a soft system, as opposed to a really hard system at the provider level. I would say that our provider community can raise its knowledge base a little bit. As I mentioned, I think at the outset, we have an STD clinic at the public health department, and we see STD patients. Sometimes they choose us despite their insurance. They could go anywhere, or sometimes they're uninsured and they come to the health department. And they may have been seen by a provider out in town and been treated for, let's say, gonorrhea. And they were given the dose of medicine that was recommended for gonorrhea that was 10 years ago. A specific example is 125 milligrams of one particular medication. The new recommended dose is 250. So I see that fairly regularly. I think that we have some providers in town who could raise their knowledge level a little bit. For other common infections, I think we're pretty good. So community-acquired pneumonia, we call it CAP. CAP is very common. Probably many of us here today have had a pneumonia before. and been treated for it. I think we're pretty good with the recommendations for CAP. I think we're pretty good with the recommendations for most skin infections, whether it's acne, just keeping the level of bacteria down with once a day or every other day antibiotics in, say, teenagers, and not giving them too much, and with other common skin infections like boils and such. Some of the places we have challenges, though, are on the infections where the first-line treatment didn't work well, and I think that we could get better with our bench. We could, if I was using a sports analogy, the second course of medicine or the third course of medicine, we as a provider community could do better at choosing the right antibiotic and the right length of time. If I could give any other sort of experience-based info, I would say that we treat some infections for too long, according to the recommendations. And one particular area of concern would be skin infections like cellulitis. There are clear recommendations on how long to treat them, when to do IV antibiotics, when to stop and switch to oral antibiotics, and how long to do the oral. Sometimes we'll see somebody on IV medicine for a month. IV medicine is expensive. It involves needles and other things, and you want to stop that as quickly as you can. So long answer to your question is we can do better. We're pretty good.
Hi, Marty Wilde, City Club member. I'm gonna give you a chance to play the If I Had $1 Million game. But I want to preface it by saying I think it's sort of widely recognized that we underinvest in prevention and public health in our society. An example being I read yesterday that because so many homeless folks in San Diego were not immunized against hepatitis, they had an outbreak, and now they're washing their streets with bleach, which has got to be a lot more expensive than giving a few shots. So, you know, if Steve Makrohiesky walks in and gives you $1 million to spend on prevention and public health, what would your priorities be for the county? What's the next thing we could do?
I can always count on Marty for those type of tough questions. I want to start with that hepatitis A outbreak. So it's ongoing right now, and it started in San Diego. And hepatitis A is pretty common. It's a virus, and it's spread usually in food and water. So you drink contaminated water or your food is contaminated. And it causes a hepatitis, as the name implies. And usually it's got an incubation period of around a month. So that makes it hard in public health. Whereas influenza, the incubation period is 2 days. If I had flu and somebody here was susceptible to it, hadn't seen that particular strain before, and I coughed on him or her, within 48 hours, he or she will be sick. But hepatitis, a month later, you might be across the country and you don't know what your exposure was. So at any rate, that outbreak has spread to other counties. It's been linked to an outbreak in Santa Cruz. They found the same virus through genetic testing in Arizona and in Utah. So it's spread. And as we got to the part about what can people do, well, this is one of those examples where vaccines are one of the answers. It's a two-dose vaccine. It works extraordinarily well. It's too bad that they didn't have a vaccination level that would have prevented this. And the other reason I wanted to kind of highlight that outbreak is because they still don't have a smoking gun. We're looking at 15 people have died from it now, as of yesterday, I believe, 15 deaths, and around 400 cases. And I'm working with our jail here because it's happened in a lot of homeless people, and some homeless people are in and out of our incarceration system. We're trying to prepare for it if it comes up here. We have a lot of people who come from California, end up in our tent camps, et cetera, and then go back to another state. So I think that it's a sobering situation, and it could happen at any time with other viruses or bacteria. So if I had $1 million that I don't otherwise have, I would really spend a good deal of time on education campaigns, and I would really focus them at the community level in focused areas of risk, and that would probably include long-term care facilities, both assisted living and the skilled nursing facilities. And also I would focus on the provider level. As the last question I implied, I think there's work to be done at the provider level to improve our prescribing and use of antibiotics. And I might, with $1 million, you can do a lot, I might give some incentives to it, you know, create little awards or rewards or little something to try to get people to be nudged into a new behavior. And I would also be open to other ideas from bright groups like City Club to help me spend that money.
Hi, Sandy Erickson, City Club member. I have a two-part question, which I hope is okay because I'm the last questioner. and that is, the first part is, we have a managed care system now that everybody gets 15 minutes with the doctor. And so...
whether they want it or not.
Right. So I'm wondering whether or not that system is also contributes to the over-prescribing of antibiotics because it saves time and, you know, kind of dispatches the patient and the problem. And then the second part of the question, which is maybe related or not, is corporations now greatly influence different professions. We know this. There's a lot of conflict of interest that there didn't used to be having to worry about. And the press has had a number of different articles about doctors serving on pharmaceutical boards, advisory committees, and all that kind of thing. And so how prevalent is the pressure on doctors to prescribe what the companies are selling?
It's nice to save the controversial questions for last. So I would say in the arena of payers and insurance companies and such, there is a healthy push and pull, I believe. The payers want to deliver quality care at a good cost. So whereas maybe Hollywood would paint them in the corner of all they care about is saving money, I think that they also care about delivering quality care. And I see a good deal of push and pull in the marketplace. A provider might want to do one particular prescription for a really expensive antibiotic, and if there's a generic one available, and if the science says it's just as good, there's no reason that that shouldn't be used. So I think that's a good thing. I also think that the push of technology, newer technologies, like electronic health records. Most of my practice, I was writing the patient's chart on a piece of paper, and only, you know, a few years ago did we all move to electronic health records. Once you're electronic, it allows you to do this systematic analysis. So I can know in, the county has 6 clinics, the community health centers of Lane County. I can know by looking at the electronic health record who's really good with skin antibiotics and lung antibiotics and GI, gastrointestinal antibiotics, and who's not really good. I can know that data really quickly instead of going through a chart page after page after page, which doesn't happen because it takes forever. So that push and pull, I think, is a good thing. On the other side of that coin, though, is the ongoing push for cost containment at all costs. And occasionally, I think that it could be argued that payers or companies get it wrong, but by and large, they do pretty well and get it right a lot of times as well. The pressure on providers is for prescribing appropriately is multifactorial. So a payer might have a list of antibiotics or a list of all medications. These are the only medications that you can use without getting prior authorization to use them. And on that list regarding antibiotics, there might be 6 different classes and a couple in each class. And if you want something special, you have to get special permission to use it. That's a pretty good push to know your science and do it well. On the other side of that coin is who makes those decisions, and are they... do they own stock in a pharmaceutical company? Are they a member of a federal committee that makes decisions on whether an antibiotic ever gets approved? I think those types of questions are more and more out in the open and being addressed. Are they fixed? I don't think they are. But I think it's better than it was earlier in my practice career, where we didn't even know if somebody on a committee who was approving a vaccine or an antibiotic also got $500,000 a year as from the Speaker's Bureau of a big pharmaceutical company. At least now we know that. I hope I answered that question, or multiple questions.
Thank you very much. So before we thank our guests today, there are a few quick announcements. City Club is very appreciative of our sponsors, including PAC Info Internet Solutions. And we want to thank public radio station KLCC 89.7 for airing City Club programs on Monday at 6:30 p.m. And a thank you to Community Television of Lane County for televising recent City Club programs. And for more details and information about future programs, you can find that online at City Club's website, cityclubofeugene.org. And now I'd really like to give a big thank you to Jason Davis and Dr. Patrick Ludke. Thank you so much for your time today. Thank you. That concludes today's program.